right, then I think we're ready to begin.
What you want me to start from the where I was born?
Well, let me just identify who we are here at the beginning of the tape. This is interview number 393. I'm with Mr. Max Sedenko. Nancy DeLette, and I'm with Mr. Max Sedenko, who lives on Deer Harbor in Washington, but today he's at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Seattle. They're checking out his eyes. So we're meeting here in the VA hospital. And it is April the 12th, 1989. It's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And we're beginning 393. Mr. Sedenko came from the Ukraine in 1923.
Mm-hmm.
From Ellis Island. Okay. Let's start your story. Tell me.
Well, I was born in 1912. The town named Pochopensi in Ukraine. It's north of south of Kiev, about 25 miles. Then my dad came to this country in 1914, and he came to Canada. And he started working on the railroad, and then the railroad shut down for the winter, so he came to North Dakota, western North Dakota. And he couldn't get the job, so my dad and my uncle and one of the other fellas. Anyway, they came to western North Dakota, and in winter time in North Dakota, even rabbits don't live there. They leave the country. So he worked for one German family taking care of. They had quite a few cattle and horses for just room and board that winter. And then in the spring, he went to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and worked in a coal mine that 1 year. And then just got too much for him, so he went and worked in the foundry, and that was even worse. So he was farmer for many years, all these years. So he went back, to North Dakota and worked on a farm for a couple of brothers. Then two brothers, they were city farmers, so they went broke. So Dad, he's got four horses from them. And then that's when he started out farming, and then he sent for mother and me. And you see, when we were there, revolution started, so we couldn't get out. He was going to send for us in a year or so, but revolution started. And I seen revolution. It's something I hate to go through it again. I've seen a grave in my time. I was only 9 years old. They had a ditch dug and they threw in 300 dead soldiers and just covered them up. And we never know who's come. One army come in and they leave, and then another army come in and they leave. We don't know who they are, what they're doing. And my uncle had a beautiful pair of horses. And they stopped and they took a saddle off of their horses and put on his horse and took off and left him. Skinny, just about half dead horses, and he doctored them for about 6 months before he got them so he could even use them. But that's the way, just wasn't no system of any kind, just terrible. So anyway, Dad finally sent us money, and we started out for this country. We got to Odessa I can think of the town. Anyway, we cut the train 20 miles from where we lived. We cut the train and we got to Odessa. And we stay. Odessa is a beautiful town. Streets just about quarter mile wide. Big, wide streets and beautiful stone buildings, really. And clean. Not like in this country you see papers laying around. Not up there. People going with the brooms made of twigs. And they sweep everything up just as clean as could be. So we stayed there 2 weeks. Then we boarded the Russian boat. And we got to, not quite to Constantinople, and the kind of an island there. And they kept us for a week. That was for the examination, you know, see if we had any sickness or anything like that. They took us off a boat and put us on this island and took us. We were supposed to take our clothes off and then bundle it, and they ran it to the steam. Well, if you had anything woolen, you know what happened to that. And some people, they went and they wrapped their shoes in that, and their shoes are about that big. So anyway, after they did that, then they, a couple of days later, they ran a boat to the Constantinople, right out to pier, not to pier, so parked it in the middle. And they had the wooden boats with the one fella would be rowing. And they unloaded us at night. And I don't know why we didn't get drowned. They put in just as many as they could get in that small boat, and fella was rowing. And here boats running back and forth, and that boat was going. I don't know. It was. I think Angel was with us, because we would have never made it otherwise. So we got to the shore, and then the big warehouse, so they separated us. Some go here, some go there. They took us to a hotel. I don't remember what name of the hotel. Anyway, we stayed on the fourth floor. And down below, there was a bar. And that piano was tinkling, that piano 24 hours a day. Somebody were playing that thing. Boy, after that, I hated to hear piano. And anyway, after 2 weeks, we got on a boat, a Greek boat, named Constantinople. I don't know why, but that's the way it is. And we went to Constantinople quite a ways. We went on a like a cable car or something like that. It's underground. You go to the top of Constantinople, you had to take this, the train that goes underground. Like a
subway?
Yeah. We had to take that to go up the hill, and we shop around there. And we didn't have too much money, mostly we looked. And then we went across the bridge to mosque. We were going to go in there, but we have to take our shoes off. So my mother, she's quite religious, but she says, I'm not taking the shoes off to go in there. And then we just, there was a Russian church there, so we went to church every Sunday. I mean, their dad serves during the week. Then we got on this boat. It was a Greek boat, but named Constantinople. We came to the stop at Greece, and they loaded big chunks of granite, some red and some gray. They were about, I'd say about foot thick, 2 foot wide, and 8 foot long. And they loaded that on the boat, put in the bottom of the boat. And they loaded another place, and they loaded raisins, bags, small bags about this big. They kept loading that damn raisins for a whole day long onto the boat. Well, I know after we started going to New York, we hit the storm. Well, first I saw first whale coming through. That's the first. I don't know what it was, but that's first. And then there was dolphins were jumping in front of the boat for quite a while. Anyway, we hit the storm, and we were about 5 days out of New York yet when we hit that big storm. And all them granite shifted to one side. So the boat was going, instead of going straight like that, it was going like that on the side, rest of the way to New York. Well, anyway, when we got to New York, they took us off of the boat and put on a little, like a ferry or some kind of a boat, and took us to Ellis Island. Well, we stayed at almost 3 weeks. The reason was that agent, his name Kunishevsky, instead of, Dad paid our fare from Odessa clear to Hillsborough, North Dakota. And it was 200, for mother and me, was $288. And this Kunishevsky, he left the tickets for boats, but he tore the ticket off for train from New York to Boston was $88. And he tore that ticket out and kept the money. So that's the reason why we stayed on that Ellis Island for 3 weeks just about. Anyway, when we got there, they looked at our papers and there's no tickets for us to get on a train. So this Konashevsky, or somebody wrote Dad and said, you better send more money, you don't have enough. You're $88 short. Well, in 1923, $88 for a day, you know, that's a lot of money. Well, Dad was lucky. Well, they, and he sent. So he went to the bank. So he went to the bank, and banker, he took the, he had the number of the draft check and everything, and number of the draft check and everything, and sent it to Ellis Island. And the next day, we were called out for our train and took off for, took off for Buxton, Hillsboro. Anyway, when we got there in November, last of October, and I started school. I went to school for 2 years in Russia before we left, and then I started school here. I had to start first grade. Well, of course, first and second grade I stayed, but when I got to third and fourth grade, I skipped third and I went right into fourth and a fourth. But we were poor. Dad couldn't afford to hire men, so I had to do most of the work. I was only 12 years old when I drove 7 horses on a plow, believe it or not. That's honest. Well, they were gentle horses. If they wanted right away, I could have never stopped them just by pushing that wall. But they were gentle, and I got along good. So my schooling, after I got out of fourth grade, my schooling was, I never started school. Well, I started the first week when school started. Then Dad will take me off to work on the farm. Then I didn't start the school again till the ground froze. And that would be, if I'm lucky, I might start before Thanksgiving. Then I'll go till the spring works opens up. And I was out of school. In those days, they didn't care. So I was out of school when the spring work started. And he was good. The school always had the last day of school, I had the picnic. He let me go to the picnic. Anyway, that's the way my schooling was all the way through. I went as far as the seventh grade. Oh my gosh, you know, no matter how smart you are, when you miss all that time, I just nicely catch up, then I have to get out. Same way again in the next year, same thing again. So I got far as seventh grade and I said, forget it, Dad. I said, I'm not going to school. Well, he didn't care if I went to school or not. And anyway, the place where we lived, it was not too good a place. So we moved closer to Hillsboro. And next year later, I had a sister. She's living in Ukiah, California now. I had a sister, and that's all that just two of us. And anyway, I stayed with him, farmed together. We farmed quite a bit of land. Then when World War II broke out, I didn't have to go. We were farming plenty of land. I could have stayed out of the service. But I just got disgusted with farming, so I went in the service. I served 2 years in the Army. I was overseas down towards northern France, that's where I served. I hit the front line. I was with any aircraft first, and then they broke up any aircraft after our army got as far as Paris. They didn't need so much any aircraft then because Germany was pushing everybody to the Russian front, so you didn't have too much over here. So that took us 600 of us that took out any aircraft and gave us rifle and put a target up there. I don't know if I hit the target or not, but I was number one infantryman. Anyway, I got wounded first in November, first time. Wasn't too bad. I was gone only 3 weeks from the outfit, and then after that I went back. But the last time I got wounded, I was in that Belgian bulge. Maybe you heard about it. And I was in that, and that was but the worst we ever run into. That whole our war was the worst we ever got into. So I got wounded pretty bad there. Well, I'll tell you how bad it was. It was three of us together. I got wounded pretty bad, and I had my left eardrum bust at the same time. But the other two guys, they were about, about 5 feet from me, and they didn't even know what hit them. That's how close I was. Anyway, they took me to the hospital, and I was there 7 weeks. And after I got out of hospital, they reclassified me, and I went into heavy auto maintenance in the garage. And boy, that was a racket. If I was from beginning the war, I think I would have stayed there yet. We stayed in Reims, France, in kind of a stadium, you know, where they have played ball there and have bicycle races and everything. We stayed in there underneath, nice and warm, dry. Had breakfast ready on the clock. We eat our beds, breakfast ready on the table. We eat breakfast. Get on the truck. They take us to the garage, only about 5 blocks, but we couldn't walk. They had to drive us to the garage. We get in the garage, check out our tools, start working on the trucks, and we, each one of us had it was about 12 of us. Each one of us had two German prisoners working with us. We worked till 12 o'clock, get on the truck, drive back, have our noon meal, and about an hour later we come back, do the same thing, 5 o'clock, back on the truck, back to the stadium, and eat supper, change your clothes, go to town. You got permanent pass, go to town, any place you want in Reims, France. And Reims, France, pretty nice town, pretty big. So that's end of my war was right there. And I got my discharge the day war ended in Europe. I got my papers to go home. They want me to stay. Oh, there's something else I tell you. I forgot. We were staying in the sanatorium, the kind of a grandstand. And right across the fence, there was a bunch of German prisoners. They were Russians. But when we took over, they were our prisoners there. And I walked over there one day. None of them could talk English. And the English captain was taking care, you know, directing them. And he didn't know a word of English, and none of the Russians knew English. So he had the Negro boy who was his driver, jeep driver. Well, this Negro, he knew a little German. It's funny. So this captain will tell a Negro boy, his driver, in English what he wants them to do. Then Negro boy will tell one of the Russian boys he knew a little German. Then he turn around and he'll tell the rest of us. And I tell you, when you start out from here and end up there, it's really funny. I was standing behind that jeep laughing like crazy. And they had our uniforms. So he didn't know whether I was one of the Russians or one of the Americans or what. I was standing there laughing my head off. Because I could understand Russian, I could understand the English. And I knew a little bit German, too. So finally, I kept laughing. And the captain, he kept looking back, Pretty soon he turned around. What in the blankety-blank you laughing about? I said, well, tell me what you want them to know. I said, I'll tell them. What? I said, just go ahead. So he told me. I just turned around and told him what he told me. And then he turned around and told me again, hey, he says, I'm going to come and get you every time I need you. Well, I didn't say nothing. Anyway, three boys were in that outfit that came from town next to where I come from. Yeah. But I never got chance to ask them anything because they asked me everything and I never got chance to ask them anything. And there was I didn't know that. But when I got back home and I was writing to my uncle and cousin, my girl, she was only about a year and a half old when my mother and I left. I was at girls' camp too. There were prisoners, you know, German prisoners, girls camp. And she was in that camp. I went over and visited one time, but, you know, when you don't know, you don't know. And my uncle, mother's brother, and his son, they were in another man's camp. I knew the camp was there, but I didn't go there. You know, if I would have gone, I might have found it. That's how close you got. Well, we were, after I was, after we got pretty well beaten up and that Belgian bulge, so we retreated about, I don't know, about 8 miles. And a fella was with me in the camp, and when I was taking basic training, he was there. I walked right past him. I didn't know who it was. And the neighbor's boy that I went, was adopted with him together. When they got wiped, they got wiped off at that Belgian bulge. We took over their area, and they were coming down what was left, and we were going up. And we didn't, I didn't know he was there. After we got back, started talking and telling what it was, where we were, and that. And, well, this Buck Ward is his name. Well, he says, that's my company, got wiped out. So it's really a funny thing happened about the war. So, well, anyway, after I got discharged, I got my traveling papers that day war ended in Europe, and that took me, Jeep took me to Paris. When I got to Paris, oh, my gosh, that was a really mess. The Jeep had to drive about two blocks from where to go into that hotel where I was supposed to stay. Or not. Took him almost an hour. People just went nuts, just wild. Climb up the light poles, climb up to any rail or anything. This just went wild. Anyway, I stayed overnight, and the next morning I was supposed to catch a train, go to Le Havre to get back. They just gave me a bunch of papers. You go ahead, well, get home well, however you can. Don't make a difference to them. So anyway, I got on the subway. And no matter, I got on the subway about three times, and I couldn't read French. I don't know where I was at. I get out when the subway gets to where I'm getting in. I don't know where I'm at. So I back on the subway, go the other way. So finally, one of the fellas got tired, and he says, well, I'll take you in the Jeep. And took, you know, you've seen that arc they have in French Chauvin? You know, arc like this here in France. You've seen these pictures all over. I went through that to get to the depot. Anyway, we got in the depot, and I got on a train that evening. They got a funny trains. You get in from outside into the car, and they shut the door, and you can't get out. That's two benches here, two benches here, four people on each bench. And that's the way you travel there. You stay there. Anyway, we got to Le Havre, and we were walking around there. And I was all alone. I don't know how to get to England. I had to get to England to get a boat to United States. So it was a boat on loan, and these boats were what they do, that Americans, they load the trucks in England, and they run on this boat just like a ferry, run on there. And then overnight they come across to French side and then run these trucks off. And then they bring your empty trucks around on the boat and go back and forth. So the sailor was standing there, and I started talking to him, and I said, do I got a chance to get across to England? Well, he says, Captain be coming down, you talk to him. So I talked to him, and he said, you got the papers? I pulled out, sure. So he got me in the boat, and I got to England, and then got to London. Do you want to stop?
Okay, we just had a pause there, and yeah. we're gonna come back from the war story you were telling us about, and
well, this is
telling us about.
This is just gonna go back to revolution. The army used to come in; they'll have all kinds of shells laying in the bottom of the wagon and rifles. So us kids used to steal the rifles and everything else. So we didn't dare shoot the rifle, so we'll tie it to a tree and then put a string on it and shoot them that way. Excuse me. Then we take a shell and lay it on a rock and hit with the other rock. That's the way we used to shoot them. You know, that bullet could have turned around and hit us. Nobody never got hurt. Just crazy kids. You hear of kids doing crazy things. Well, I did it myself. And well, I don't know much more I could tell you about that. It's about...
So that was a really rough period then for your mother. Oh,
yeah,
your
yeah.
Father had left.
Yeah, and we had the year before we left, they had awful starvation over there. It was just terrible. They didn't get any crop. They, you know, these local trees, locusts, you know, they have big white blossoms. They take them blossoms, grind and dry them and grind them, and they were making bread out of that. Anything, whoever had the cow, they saved. And then finally rye got ripe enough, and they ground the rye before it even was ready, and kids got eaten that bread. Some of them ate so much that they just blew up and died. You know, they starved so long. And you better shut her off. I don't have much to say right about that. So, I don't know what more I could tell you.
Tell me more about that period in the village. I'm sorry, what was the name of the town?
Pochopensee.
Mm-hmm.
And
how did your mother get through that period, you and your mother?
Well, she, my grandfather, her father, he was pretty, he knew how to do things, you know. He could do things. He managed pretty good. He didn't have too much trouble.
Did you live together with your grandfather?
Well, for a while, we lived with dad's folks. Dad's parents, you know, we lived with them, and then later on she moved over to her father and stayed with them, with him. He was real good man, but he was strict. Boy, you had to walk the straight line. No step in the side. That's why I became good. anyway.
When your father left, how did he get the chance to leave?
You see, we had the sugar beet plant only about 2 miles from our little town. And he was a coachman in the sugar beet plant, you know, holding this. the railroad was 20 miles away. So some of these big shots, you know, in the mail, they had to go either Kiev or Germany or someplace. So he'll take them to the railroad and stay there overnight, and next night he'll come back. They had the carriages with four horses. So that's what his job was. Finally, he just got tired of it. He heard about America. First, he was going to go to South America, and then he decided to come to this country. And when he went to, first he came to Canada, work on a railroad. Then he came to North Dakota. And then he was going to go back to Canada, but you couldn't go back to Canada. You had to stay in North Dakota. Canada won't allow you. So... Well, anyway, after the war, I went in the hospital. I was in the hospital in Fargo and Veterans Hospital for 7 weeks. Then I got out of the hospital, and I took my basic training in Camp Cal in San Diego, so I knew what California was a lot better than North Dakota. So my sister was driving Greyhound bus in San Francisco, so I went to visit her, and that's where I met my wife. And I got married, and we've been living now 41 years, 3 years to March. And I don't know what more I could tell you.
Well, I'll ask you some more questions. We're going to turn the tape over now.
Okay.
That's the end of side one of interview number 393 with Max Sedenko. This is the beginning of side two of interview number 393 with Mr. Max Sedenko.
Okay. Well, when we got to Ellis Island, we stayed there, like I said, we stayed there over 2 weeks. And every night, we'll have a meal. There was a lot of people there. They're most of them were Italians at that time.
What was the year? What was the year again? Sorry.
1923. They'll take us to the big, great big room, and I had a table. They must be about 40 foot long. And fella, he'll have a stack of plates like this here, and he start throwing the plates as he walk along. By the time he gets to the end of the table, the first plate still spinning around. Then after we eat our supper, then we come back, then they give us pillow and a blanket, and we go up a different room, different times, I don't know what rooms. And we stay there overnight. Then next morning, we just leave a pillow and blanket there. We come down and wash up and everything, then we go and have breakfast. And the rest of the day, we just walk around. There was nothing else to do. One Sunday, they took us, let us out. See, the buildings clear around, and we were inside. There were no way out for us to get out of there. But one Sunday, they let us outside, and we were right across from Statue of Liberty. We could see Statue of Liberty right across. I've seen Statue of Liberty three times. So I know four times, actually. That's about all we've been doing. And there was nothing else to do. Some of the kids play games and what they can, and some of fighting. Was a lot of fighting. Then when we left, that's about all I could tell you.
You
about.
Had to wait there the whole time because you didn't have the train.
Yeah, train ticket. Yeah, yeah. That's what we could have got on the train the next day, but in kind of that.
Did you have to go through a medical examination?
Oh yeah, yeah. I had. You see the smallpox. You know, they make a kind of a scar.
Yeah.
Well, I couldn't take, so that kept cutting me in the car. Every time we stopped, they'll cut me. But the dentine wouldn't take, wouldn't show. So they kept cutting and believed that I had a shot already. Because they didn't, I think every port we stop or any place we stop, that's the first thing they did. Tried to make me take the smallpox, but it didn't work. So I finally got by. Well, I don't know what more I could tell you.
Were you speaking Russian? Were there other Russians on Ellis Island at that time?
No. There was only about six Russians that were on the island that came with us on the boat from Turkey. No, it wasn't many. One lady, doggone it. One lady and a boy about her age, they came from Odessa, and her husband come and got her same day because she was right there. And when we got to North Dakota, mother, she gave us her address, and mother used to write to her. Well, she got a couple of letters from her. And after that, mother sent a letter and letter come back. And she was one of these, she wasn't satisfied with anything, so I think she went back. I'm pretty sure she did. So,
tell me about the trip then out to North Dakota.
Well, we got on the train. It wasn't too bad. We had to buy our food because at that time food didn't cost too much. And we got to North Dakota, and the town that's Hillsboro, that's a county seat. But Dad, he lived 8 miles farther down, a little town, Buxton. So, conductor, he let us off of the train, and that's all it is, just one little hotel, a couple of grain elevators, and a couple of old shacks. That's a whole town. Post office was in the hotel. Well, we stood by the track. We don't know what to do, where to go, or anything. Dad knew we were coming, but he lived 7 miles out in the country. So, finally, the hotel manager, he kind of heard that we were coming, so he came over and got us, and we went in the hotel and stayed there till Dad come us and pick us up. He came with horses. He didn't come. We didn't have a car. He didn't buy a car till 1926. He finally bought the car, and before that, he just used horses. So
you hadn't seen your father then since?
No, I haven't seen him. I didn't even know him.
So you were being introduced to your father?
Pardon?
So you were like being introduced to your
father? Yeah, that's true.
What was that like?
Yeah, that's true. And I don't know what more I could tell you. Well, after I got married, we got, my wife, she was married before, just a tramp that she married. And they lived 3 years, and she had a little boy. And after I married, I adopted a little boy. He's 44 now, living in California. He's an insurance agent, making big money, but spending faster. So anybody can have two Continentals at one time. That's a little too much. That $22,000 each. And that's what he's got. We got three grandchildren, two girls, and a boy is 18, and one girl 17, and the youngest girl, she's 12. She got chance to go from four of them from California, and she was one of them chosen, go to Georgia, and Mrs. Reagan was there, you know, fighting about the drugs and everything, and she was one of them. Going over there, oh, she was flying up in the air, you know, when she come back. And first thing she come to her dad. She said, you know, Dad, they have to speak with accent over there. and her father, Michael's name, he figured that the school gonna pay for that trip. No, he stuck for $450. Always says it's worth it. He says, Holly had a good time, and I get along a lot better with that adopted boy than I do with my own. My own lives in Queen Anne Hill here in Seattle. And I get along a lot better with that with one that's adopted. He's real, real nice kid, except he don't save money. He just easy come, easy go.
Well, what about that first period when you first got, you had to get adjusted to life in North Dakota? It must have been so different.
Sure was different. Living out in the country, temperature gets down to 35, 40 below zero. And I had to go to school. It was 2 miles, one school. I started one school, and then two sisters were teachers, and one lived next to us, and it was nice. I could ride with her to school and back again after school. But then the school was in a different township than we were. So I had to change to another school. So I had to ride a horseback. And I tell you, when it's 30 below zero and you get out on that horse, it's pretty cool. It's warm here, and that's about the only place. And then that spring we moved to about 20 miles to another farm. And we lived there, and it was nice. The school just was next to the farm, just about. And another thing.
Was it good land that your father had?
Oh, yeah, there? Yeah, that was good. We were renting, we didn't buy that. Anyway, I'll tell you another story about our coming from Ukraine. You see, back then we raised an awful lot of sugar beets. We had the sugar mill, we raised a lot of sugar beets, great big one. So when that wrote us before we left, he says, will you please bring sugar beet seeds over here? So mother, she, I don't know, maybe a dozen or so, she picked up and brought it with her. Then when we were renting this farm, he was a governor of North Dakota for 3 terms, and then he had a bank in town Hillsboro, and it was his farm we were renting from. So Dad, we had a little garden out in the field there, and Mother was raising carrots and stuff, and she seeded these beets on one end. She seeded the beets on one end, and he happened to drive by and see these beets. And he says, what is that, spinach? And Dad said, no, sugar beets. He says, I didn't know sugar beets can grow here. So he said, I'd like to see some of them. And when do you dig them? And Dad said, well, this fall. So he dug out. They were about that big, that long. Gave it to him.
Can you do that again? How big is that?
About that big.
They're
8 inches
around.
They're about, more than 8 inches around. They're about 8 inches across the top. So because it's really good landing. So he took the beats and he talked around and everything else. Then next 2 years later, he planted, he got seed. They didn't know that you could get seed here, but southern states, you know, there is beets all along. So this E.Y. Sars, his name, he got the seed from south and brought it. He had a little farm, just a small pad, about 40 acres. So he planted the beets, but in those days they didn't have machinery. They had to have a Mexican to, you know, clean the weeds and tame them and dig them by hand with the spade. So he raised these beets. They were nice beets. But he had no way to get rid of them. He had to ship them clear south. I don't know where he, Louisiana or someplace he shipped them. So it cost too much. So he started working, and since he was a governor, you know, he got connections. So started working with everything. So they finally built a sugar beet plant in Grand Forks, North Dakota. And now, anybody want to raise the beets, they have to get on a list, and only way they can get on a list if somebody quit. Everybody want to raise beets because it's a big money. So now in a 100-mile area, they got 6 sugar beet plants. And that, it's eastern North Dakota. It's only about 10 miles from Red River, from Minnesota border. So everybody want to raise because it's a big money in it. 1 year, I work on a sugar beet plant 1 year. I was making powdered sugar. And you know, powdered sugar has a 3% starch, keep it from hardening. I had to, when I was making this powdered sugar, I take a sample, and lab man from the lab come and he test it, and then he called me over loudspeaker, says either decrease starch or increase starch, and I'll have to do that. It was pretty good job. I had a room a little bit bigger than this, all by myself. I had to make at least 60-100 pound bags, grind up real fine. Well, if I get the dry sugar, I can no problem, but if I get the fresh wet sugar, I'm having a hard time. So what I did, I had 2 records. One I kept for the company, and one I kept for myself. Someday I make more than I should. So I put them in a warehouse, and in a storeroom, and I'll have my list. When I short, I just take off of there and fill her up. And foreman, he says, you know, it's something fishy here. The fella that's relieving you, I work day shift and he leaves swing shift. And a lot of times he'd be short, you know, when he gets the wet sugar. But he says, you never short. He says, I checked warehouse after you left. He said there was amount what you wrote on the list. How did you do it? I never did tell him till I quit that spring. He said, you sneaky devil. of course, next spring, next fall, my wife and the boys, they said she came from California. So they want to go to California. So I had a dairy farm, and I worked an iron range for 3 years. It was a pretty good job, but was too far from home, 200 miles from home. Anyway, after this sugar beet job, next year I work. We had a big storm come through that area, and it was a big tornado, and it just took about a mile and a half just tore everything down. Big warehouse where the trucks was stopping over there. Big beams about that big, and just twisted them like a little wire. And it was a Catholic school there. Blowing school, they found report cards from them, from kids from that school 30 miles away. And every building in that school was down, blown down to the ground. But statue Holy Mary was still standing in the middle of the yard. That's honest. Big statue, about 7 foot tall. Never touched it. So Catholic was bragging about that. They said, the God with us. So anyway, wife and kids, they went to California and spent time with her parents. Her dad died, but her mother was still living. And then when they come back, they said, California. We want to go to California. And I just got tired. I was making pretty good money by then. I had the winter time I could work a sugar beet plant because it's a steady job if I want to go back. And in the summertime I was farming and doing some contract work. So I didn't say a word. I went over to an auctioneer and I said, Carl, when do you have open date for the auction? He says, only open date I have is 24th of March. It's 1959. So I had the auction. And wife and kid didn't know anything till auction bill come out, you know, all over the country, you know, to show the auction. So then we have a sale. We moved to California, Ukiah, California, and I started working in the woods. It was good money in the woods, cutting redwoods, good money, but in summertime we can't work in daytime, kind of the fire. The last 2 weeks I worked there, we did fight fires, you know, they got stupid deal there. They opened deer season, lasted July and August when the hottest weather. And the guys walking around smoking cigarettes, they just throw first thing you know, it's fire. So we kept fighting that fire for 2 weeks. That's all we did, fought the fire. Says, the heck with this noise, I want a job. We got paid where we was cutting, but when we were fighting fire, we didn't get paid. So then I got a job at the Masonite plant. You know, it's a hardboard. I got job there. I got 1st of October, I got job, and I worked there 15 years and retired. That's what I did. Well, I didn't. I was supposed to work 20 years, but I couldn't do it. my asthma got so bad, so I got the early retirement. I worked 15 years, but I had to work till I was 75, but I worked till 72, retired. And then we bought a lot in 69 over here in Orcas. And I bought the Masonite back there at the plant. The boards, the 9 foot high and 4 foot wide, and I got them for $1.62, but I had to haul them over here. But I went to Mount Vernon, and I was short one board. Went to Mount Vernon, and that same board, they won a $14.95. And so that's a save, and that's the reason we got the house built and paid for, because we... well, we sold the house in Ukiah before we moved over here and built here. So.
Tell me more about when you were cutting the redwoods in California.
Yeah. Well, you see, they got the redwood. The biggest we ever cut was 14 foot through. We had the 7 foot saw, so we had to cut from both hands, both sides, before we cut it down. And one tree, it was just as straight as a string. Branches on one side, perfect. And boss came over and he says, I want you to cut that tree down. And it was around 4 o'clock. Oh, later than that. So I cut it down. I wedged it and everything, cut it down, got it clear through. And that tree stood just as straight as a string, wouldn't fall over. And the fella was running Caterpillar. He wanted to come and push it over the Caterpillar. I said, don't you ever do it, because that tree, you start pushing here, I'll come over right over him on a cat. I said, leave it alone. And the road was only about 30 feet from the tree, and the tree was about at least 75 to 100 feet tall. And in the bottom was about, I'd say it was about 50 inches through on the bottom.
And how many men were saw through the base?
Well, just me, chainsaw. Chainsaw. I had a 7 foot bar chainsaw. No, I was all alone. And so boss came alone and he said, well, I guess you're going to camp here overnight. If that tree don't fall over, you can't leave. Well, I can, because road was people driving back and forth along the road. So he said, well, I'll go home. It was about 40 miles to town. He said, I'll go home and I'll bring this sleeping bag and some lunch for you, he says, and you'll have to stay here all night, watch the traffic, you know, in case the tree come down. And he started walking to his pickup, and just about that time, a little breeze came over, and over that tree went. And you know where it went? Right over the road. Right across the road. So I took a chain chainsaw, and I cut the just wide enough for the cars to go through, and then took a Caterpillar. I run Caterpillar too because I was on the farm. I run all kinds. So I took a Caterpillar, rolled the other chunk out of the way, and I went home. I slept in bed instead of on the rocky ground. Well, I don't know more what I could tell you. I just about run out of talk.
No, I think you could talk forever. All right, let's just pause for a minute.
Ready?
You're gonna tell me a little more about Pechopinchee.
Yeah, they have a kind of like a homestead there, a piece of land. They have a fruit trees and garden and their home. But the land what there is green on, there is real green. The soil back there, black soil is 6 foot deep. They raise anything out there. So their land, what they raise green, they'll have four different areas. So you see, this field, they will raise winter wheat and winter rye. They'll seed either wheat or rye here. They'll plant oats or barley over there. And there's millet. They go quite a bit for millet because they use that as a food. Excuse me. So they'll have millet here. And this field over here, they call a plow summer fall. They plow sometimes last of June and then keep it black so the weeds kill the weeds. Then next year, they'll seed the weed over here and then just keep on going around. They don't seed same crop on same land. They just keep switching around. And the homes, they're like I said, they had a garden, fruit trees, and they live in there, and that's the way the town is. And they don't count people in town. They count homes. They had about 240 homes in that little town, and it was kind of a rolly. And about 2 miles from us, there was a big timber area, and that didn't belong to us. That belonged to some, I don't know, some prince or princess or something. And this land where they said they plow, they call it summer fall, what they plow in the summer. The kids, they'll herd the cattle or sheep out there. And if animal ever, they got a ditch dug around them. If animal ever got across the ditch, don't even bother going and getting it because that belongs to the whoever woods that belongs to, that's theirs. It used to have been terrible over there. They, well, you heard a lot of churches closed up there in Russia. You heard that. You know why? Well, I tell you why. Every church, they had so much land to it, and each priest, he had so much so many cattle, so many horses, and he had the people working. And he got from government, he got $5 a day. A lot of them, they didn't even, my dad when he was in the army, he was the Tsarina's guard in the army. They had to be over 6 foot tall, or my dad was 6 foot two. So he was in her army. Whenever she went, he went with her. You know, the whole battalion went with her. Anyway, they used to make them go to church, you know, on Sunday. So one Sunday, Dad says him and four other fellas, they were near Moscow there, and they told them that they had to go to church. So they went to church, supposed to go to church. They just went over the dike and lay there in the sun. When they come back, oh, they were really religious. They was making the cross and everything. And sergeant came over and he says, "Why did you go to church?" "Oh, this little church over here." He says, "You bunch of liars." He said, "They're not even priests. The priests live in Germany. And that they have a like deacon and a guard, watchman. They ring bell every morning. They great for bells in the Russian church. They ring the bell, and just like they're gonna have service, and that's all. There's nobody there." So he made them scrub horses for 2 weeks because they were cavalry, you see. And anyway, so all these churches, like our church in our town, we had a big church in our town. Dad even helped build it. He went and got the a lot of big timbers over to Siberia, you know, great big timbers for the church. He helped build. It was a real big one. And we didn't have any problem to keep a church going because people were coming and were paid. Well, this church, like the one that I told you about the dead went to, there were no people to it. So what they going to do? They had to close it. But in our town, church was all the time. During all the revolution, they still had the church there because people kept the priest going. When I was going to school, they made us, they were pretty strong in religion then during the Tsar. This was still Tsar. The priest come to school every once a week. We had, I think, learn on Wednesday. And we had to learn Bible in Greek. It wasn't Russian, it was in Greek Bible. I knew a little Greek then, but I forgot all about it. And he'll sit, you know, like desk here, kids sitting back here. And he'll sit on the front desk, and he had the long hair, and he was old, heck, he must have been close to 90. And he'll sit in the desk, and he'll call on one of the kids to get in the front and recite, you know, what he learned. Well, kids get standing in the front, they're talking, and one kid behind the priest, he'll take one hair and pull, and priest go like that. And you know, that kid in the front, he can't talk, you know, he's just laugh, bust his laughing, and priest picks up the ruler, walks over there, whack, whack. So we never learned too much from him. It was terrible. Whatever he gave, it was, we might as well not even be in a class. Some of the kids on purpose, they'll miss that day because they couldn't learn nothing. They're afraid they're going to get beaten with that ruler. So, well,
how did your father then, if he was in the army, how did he avoid, how was he able to leave Russia?
Well, that's after he served his term. It's 6 years mm-hmm. after he served his term. And then he was discharged. Then that's what. Then he went to work for the sugar mill, you know, coachman. And back then, army was there was a good deal. After you serve your 6 years, you get out and any job you want. Excuse me. Government will give him a job. That is, if you can handle it. And that job is your lifetime, as long as you live. That's your job. Unless you goof up, of course. But as long as you take care. My grandfather, Dad's father, when he was in the service, they had to serve 20 years. When he was. So when he got out, He didn't want a big job. He wanted a lazy job. He was a watchman on this in the sugar mill. He was a watchman. He had a they have a great big gate, and whenever this coachman come, they'll have a bell in the front of the tongue, you know, and that'll ring. When he hears that bell, he gets up, open the gate. When they go through, he closes. He might have to do that once in 12 hours. And then he had a little shack. He go in the shack and he sit there or sleep or whatever he wants. When he hears that bell come up, and he did that all well from the time he got discharged to the revolution. He was a guard there nights. He took a night. And I don't know. He liked that job. And all the time he'll have a Christmas and Easter off. It's only days he has off. And he says, I don't understand. He says, every time I go to church, he said, they either say Merry Christmas or Happy New Year or Happy Easter. That's
okay, we're going to pause here for a second. Unfortunately, when we went off tape to pause, it turned out that the people here at the Veterans Administration Hospital needed to see Mr. Sedenko. So he's gone off now. That concludes interview number 393 with Mr. Max Sedenko, and it is about 5:15.